Listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio AM 820 brings you The Catholic Doctors, discussing medicine in light of church teaching. And now, The Catholic Doctors with Dr. Michael Parker and Dr. Will Turek.
Welcome to The Catholic Doctors Show, a production of St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. This is your co-host, Dr. Michael Parker, with Dr. Will Turek. How are you, Will?
I'm doing great, Mike.
It's good to see you in your Cleveland Browns attire.
Indeed.
Celebrating the recent draft choices of the Cleveland Browns.
That's why I'm wearing this.
As somebody said to me, at least they didn't do anything stupid.
Yeah. They didn't, you know, draft another quarterback that can go into rehab or anything nasty like that.
Well, you know, speaking of the Browns, formerly known as the Cardiac Kids, we have a topic for today's show that kind of goes along that line.
Nice segue.
It was,
man,
a nice segue,
that was,
wasn't that?
Good.
No, I think we have a great topic for the show today, and we have a great guest to help us through this topic, and it's something that I think everybody should pay attention to. And today we're going to try and provide just a little bit of a primer on this, and that's called Physician Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment, or as it's, the acronym is known as, is PULSED.
It's kind of sweeping the nation here.
It is sweeping the nation. It's something that is becoming more and more common, especially with the introduction of the Affordable Care Act and a number of regulations that were placed in there regarding end-of-life issues and care for the chronically ill and the elderly.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I remember, and you probably did this as an intern as well, the whole year you're dealing with the infirm, the terminally sick, you know, and talking about DNRs and how those have evolved. I remember, you know, having long conversations with folks trying to get them to sign these papers, you know, that we don't have to tube them, we don't have to put them on a breathing machine, on and on and on. And I remember thinking to myself after that internship year, I thought, my gosh, I don't feel like I really know what I'm saying to these people.
Right.
I felt like a blooming idiot.
Right.
You know?
And it is a difficult conversation to have because, as we know in medicine, those end-of-life decisions can change on a moment's notice.
Yeah.
And the difficulties that we're facing now is we want people with these PULSE programs and a number of other programs that are coming out is we want people to give us knowledge beforehand of what they would expect. Some of this comes from Terry Schiavo. Some of it comes from other chronic vegetative states where people, you know, we didn't quite understand what they would want to live through, and we could only rely on secondhand knowledge from this. And so this is, in a way, some way that we can try and have some idea of what the patient should want. But before we, you know, go any further about what we know and don't know about these types of procedures, why don't we bring somebody in who knows a lot more than that, and that is Dr. John Berhaney. Dr. Berhaney may be familiar to you. He's been on our show before, but he is now with the National Catholic Bioethics Center as the Director of Institutional Relations. Before that, he was with the Catholic Medical Association as the Executive Director from 2006 to 2014. And during that time, he worked with a number of other doctors to write a white paper called The Pulsed Paradigm and Form, Facts and Analysis. John, welcome to the Catholic Doctor Show.
Hey, it's great to be on with you guys again.
Well, John, give us a little bit of where does the pulsed paradigm come from? What does this stem out of?
Well, let me give you a historical answer and then maybe kind of a causal answer. Historically, it comes out of Oregon, and you can trace its roots back to 1991 when people at Oregon Health Sciences University began to put together a new type of documentation of end-of-life wishes. They worked on it for a number of years, and then something very important happened. You mentioned about how it seems to be everywhere or coming everywhere, you know, to a theater near you. And in 2004, they, along with some others, formed something called a National Pulsed Paradigm Task Force. And it really was a framework with a lot of funding from major foundations to support the distribution of this nationwide. And since that happened, they have a framework for encouraging people, for sort of saying this is what it means to have this sort of pulsed form and program. And there are only 5 states right now that essentially have no action on pulsed. There are 15 states that have very established programs that are endorsed by this task force. There are 30 states that are in some process of development, including your home state of Ohio, and like I said, just five, you know, that aren't. Now, that's sort of historically and even geographically where it came from, but causally, where does it come from? You know, it does come from, I think, a certain frustration in healthcare that so many times at the end of life, you have a patient who's in bad shape. There are many options that a modern hospital and doctors can bring, but they don't know what the patient's wishes are, or they're not clear enough, or there's a document somewhere around, but they can't find it, you know, or none of those things exist, but the family can't agree. And so it's led to a certain frustration, and the whole post program came out of a desire, I think, if you step back and just look at it, to have much greater clarity and much greater predictability at the end of life. And those aren't bad goals in themselves. There's no virtue in confusion or uncertainty, but I do think it's a good question of at what price, you know. You've heard the saying, you know, that you get a shotgun to kill a fly, you know, or something like that. When you really want to do something, sometimes you say, I need something really big and powerful to get this job done. But big and powerful tools or means have some potentially dangerous side effects, and I think that's the case with the post program. So,
well, John,
if I can, just put it in a little bit of context, because I think most people have heard about advanced directives. Many people have heard the term living will. This is something that came about in the 70s, and essentially, if someone was in a coma, had a terminal condition, and was not likely to recover, what they could do is sign a living will, and it said, essentially, it holds the doctors harmless from not providing treatment that was sort of the default. You know, essentially, if someone's sick or injured or in need of care, the default is you take care of them. And a living will said, if I'm in this kind of bad condition, you know, with almost no time to live, and they would have language in a state of permanent unconsciousness from which I'm unlikely to recover, then I permit my doctor to not do certain things. So it was kind of a license to withhold or withdraw life-sustaining treatment.
John,
go ahead.
In that context, with a living will and an advanced directive, those types of things don't get started until the inciting event. So if somebody's in a car accident and is in a comatose state, that would bring in this, I don't want to be on a ventilator and those types of things. Isn't there a difference between that and what Pulse is? Doesn't Pulse start immediately?
Yes. So, you know, one of the things, and as you say, there is a kind of a triggering event, and that triggering event usually is, you know, if I'm in a terminal condition, you know what I mean? So, yes, I mean, there's something like that. And the thing about Pulse is it is not tied. I mean, it's in practice, it's supposed to be tied to a thing like that, but it's not necessarily tied. So when it is filled out and signed, it takes effect. That is one of the things, and one of the complaints I know when I was with the CMA that we had about it is it's potentially unethical in that people can refuse treatment. Even treatment that might be ordinary and beneficial, if they say in advance, if I'm ever in this kind of a situation and they're not clear about the details, I don't want this, there might be something that is ordinary or proportionate to do in those cases. And it sort of permits them and even facilitates the decision to not make that decision at the right time. So you're right. That's one thing about it.
Well, the thing is what really distinguishes between a do not resuscitate order, a DNR, and a pulsed order? Because, I mean, in their literature, I mean, it seems like it's ambiguous. It doesn't seem to be all that clear.
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. Let me mention one other thing, instrument used at the end of life called a durable power of attorney for healthcare. which is a form people could sign naming someone to speak in their name, and they often include a little section in them where they can record their wishes. This is something that a patient can download from the state and fill out. When it's signed, it's notarized. But people could even write down their own wishes. So these are the tools we've had for years, living wills back to the 70s, durable power of attorney, things from the 80s. These have been around, and people, some people at the, in end-of-life care felt they haven't worked very well. Again, something like less than 25% of people ever get around to filling them out. There's a certain variability in the forms. They are patient-generated, most of the time, and sometimes it can't be found. You name it. So those things are there. Where does Pulse come in? Here's a couple major differences. And remember, I said they're looking for clarity and predictability. So one thing is there's a very structured form with some very basic ways of conveying what somebody wants. Check boxes with only a few options. I mean, that's number one. And number two, you mentioned the term DNR, which means do not resuscitate. You know, that's giving people cardiopulmonary resuscitation.
Right.
That is one decision that often is made at the end of someone's life, but there are others. You know, there's a whole range of other treatment options that typically people have to make decisions about,
right,
including nutrition and hydration. And what the Pulsed form does is it takes all of these things, which are typically discussed and decided at the end of life, and rolls them up into one simple form. So the DNR is, essentially is the first box you check, yes or no, and there are several more after that. So it rolls a lot of these things into one form. That's the first thing. The second thing is this becomes a medical order. It is signed by a physician, and then it is entered into the patient's record. In fact, it's put on top. And now it's a medical order, which is supposed to be followed first.
Right.
First and ask questions later. And, you know, you can only treat people, as you both know, in medicine with their consent. So if you do something against patient's wishes, and now against medical orders based on patient's wishes, you can get in a lot of trouble. So making it a medical order and a permanent part of that patient's record is the second major difference that Pulse makes.
Well, John, you make a good point there that this is a permanent part of the patient's medical record, because this does get transported from facility to facility with the patient. So if they're in a nursing care facility, or even if they're at home, or if I'm admitted at one hospital and I have a Pulse at that hospital, that Pulse will go with me to another hospital if I go there. This becomes a permanent part of your record, correct?
That's correct. And there are instructions about how to cancel that. That's true. But it's, it seems to me what is certainly very possible is, people kind of forget what gets buried, if you will, or just becomes, just a part of saying, oh, yeah, I mean, that's the record thing. I do think people will easily forget it's there. So there are instructions. It becomes part of that patient's record. Here's an interesting twist, though. On the one hand, they wanted to make it a medical record in part so that to increase the chances and even the force so that it would be followed. On the other hand, they don't treat Pulse like every other medical record, because if someone is in a nursing home and then, they get sick, they get an infection, they're sent to the hospital, all of the medical orders that they've been under are reviewed and rewritten. This always happens to ensure that a patient is getting the appropriate care, the appropriate time, in the appropriate setting. Pulse is the one order. It could be canceled, but apart from that, it isn't reviewed and it isn't rewritten. It's supposed to stay the same, and that's potentially dangerous. What if a patient's wishes change? What if the patient's condition changes? And yet, this has been locked in.
Right. You're listening to the Catholic Doctor Show, a production of St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. Remember, you can hear us every Wednesdays at noon and Sundays at 2:30 p.m. on St. Gabriel Radio. You can also find us on Facebook at The Catholic Doctors and also on Twitter at Catholic Doctors. We're talking with Dr. John Berhaney about PULSED, or Physician Oldest for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And, John, I'm looking at a copy of the State of Oregon's PULSED form here in studio. And it seems that this form can be rather ambiguous, especially for Catholics, especially when you look at artificially administered nutrition. When they talk about no artificial nutrition by tube, now some people might say that as a gastric tube going into the stomach, but they might also consider that to be an IV tube. Are there a number of different ambiguities about the PULSED forms that could be problematic for Catholics?
Yes, and that's one that can treat nutrition and hydration as one more thing simply to be refused or even refused on behalf of a patient. Yes, because, you know, under Catholic teachings, nutrition and hydration, even if assisted, is essentially part of ordinary care or the most ordinary forms of treatment. Whereas I would say in the secular world, nutrition and hydration, especially assisted, is viewed as a kind of a life-sustaining treatment, like a ventilator, and that's how the PULSED form treats it. There's also an option on that Oregon form, and many others, under Section B, comfort measures only, you know,
right.
And under that, someone gets essentially nothing, you know, except palliative measures, but nothing that would cure, nothing that would treat in any respect. Now, that gets me back, you know, again to PULSED. There are some good intentions with it. As I said, there can be uncertainty about someone's wishes. There can be confusion about what they really wanted or if they wrote a form out themselves. Have we met the conditions, you know, for applying it? But at what cost, you know, clarity and predictability? When they started this thing, they said, look, this form is going to be so sort of clear and powerful that it should be filled out for people who have about 6 months to live.
Right.
And then they gradually expanded it to a year to live. So, you know, you might want to use this form if you have a patient and you believe that patient will be dead in less than a year. However, that time frame continues to be expanded. In fact, when New Jersey passed its law, they said that the time frame for use is either less than 5 years to live, or
wow,
the form could be used by anybody who wished to clarify and record their wishes about care. Well, that's a problem, right? Because, again, when this thing's in effect, it's the medical order.
It sticks.
And everyone, including other doctors, are supposed to follow it. So that's highly problematic.
Wait.
And, you know, you guys as doctors know, doctors struggle to predict who's going to die and when. Some people you think are going to die manage to keep living, and some people you think they're going to live for years die unexpectedly. I mean, it is really hard, except for some, you know, cases of cancer and things,
right,
and where they're at. But many, many serious conditions, it's hard to know when someone's going to die.
We're frequently wrong. So, you know, it's interesting, John, as I'm looking through the Oregon or the National PULSED website, they point out in here on the fourth post on this, it says the PULSED form allows patients to have their religious values respected. For example, the PULSED form allows Catholics to make decisions consistent with the USCCB ethical and religious directives for Catholic health services and ensures that those decisions will be honored in an emergency across transitions. That tells me that they already knew that they were going to get assaulted from the Catholic hierarchy and from those who espouse Catholic values. I mean, is this really consistent?
Well, you know, it's a good question. I would say it certainly doesn't facilitate making decisions consistent with Catholic faith. I mean, there, you know, is it possible? It is a tool, and could someone write all over it and adapt it? I guess they could, but it certainly doesn't make it easy. And in fact, the bishops of Minnesota and Wisconsin, together as a group, have each written letters strongly critical of Pulsed and telling Catholic hospitals in their state not to use it. So the other thing, though, even apart from our teachings, and they're significant, is the forms themselves sometimes don't even follow some of the most basic ethical considerations we want to see. I mean, if you look at the Oregon form, at the bottom, if it says signature of patient or surrogate recommended. Yeah. You know, this is a serious medical order, and yet documentation of consent by the patient or that person authorized to speak for them is only recommended and not required. And that, again, is where this differs from other medical orders. You know, a typical DNR order, if a doctor gets that, that has to be, you know, the patient or surrogate has to give informed consent.
Absolutely.
That has to be documented. Now, I should point out that not every state form is exactly the same. And in fact, Pulsed goes by slightly different names in different states. Some places it's called MOLST, like Medical Orders for Life-Sustaining Treatment.
I remember seeing that.
Physician.
Yeah.
But there are differences. And I'll tell you, the state of Louisiana, the bishops in the Catholic Conference worked with legislators, and they made a number of changes that were helpful, including requiring patient signatures. So, you know, it's a tool, you know, hey, just like a nuclear bomb, right? Just like a handgun, these things are tools, and the more powerful they are, the more careful we need to be with them. And this Pulsed form is a very powerful tool.
Well, it's interesting because, as I said in the top of the show, there was a lot of confusion in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s about what exactly we were telling people when they signed DNR orders, when we, you know, and when we were talking about end-of-life issues in a critical situation. So I appreciate the fact that there needs to be some, I guess, standardization, something that needs to consolidate this discussion and help physicians and nurse practitioners and PAs to have these difficult conversations. The problem is, though, that the problem I see anyway is that this carries over from chart to chart to chart, and this is a part of the medical record. It is in order, and you can be sued. As a result of not following that order in a particular situation. So I have some grave concerns about this whole thing.
Sure.
Being
and one thing this does, and as you mentioned at the beginning of the show, I helped to write a white paper that the Catholic Medical Association issued on this topic. This can put doctors in a very difficult situation because, let's just say a patient signed a Pulsed in the state of Ohio, but then they moved to the state of Pennsylvania. You know, they moved to be closer to family.
Sure.
They're brought into the ER. Now, they might have, again, a urinary tract infection. They have a high fever. They come into the ER, and let's say they call up the electronic health record, and right at the top, it's like Pulsed. This patient has a Pulsed, and they mm-hmm. want only palliative care. They don't want anything. And the doctor says, well, wait a minute. I mean, this patient, they have a minor infection, but that's treatable. I mean, how do I know, that this is right to let the patient go at this time? I mean, what kind of counseling, you know, did the patient get when they filled this out?
Right.
And I tell you, there's a doctor, I know one of the CMA members
John,
in Oregon
I
who had
to,
just this situation happen, and he treated the patient's infection. It was a simple infection. Turned out the patient was a World War II vet. I think the form was signed after a pretty cursory presentation of, you don't want to be hooked up to all those tubes, when it's your time to go. And, brought the patient back with a simple antibiotic. And the patient, I think, lived for months, if not well, more than a year, still telling his stories, you know, of what he had done. But it puts the doctor in a very difficult situation because, on the one hand, he's responsible for the patient, but on the other hand, his hands have been tied by the fact that this medical order is in place and right. not supposed to be countermanded.
Yeah. John, we're running out of time. I hate to cut you off. Just one quick, just a quick question and a quick answer.
Sure.
What should Catholics sign? What should Catholics have? Should they have an advance directive, a living will, or should they avoid post, have or sign post or post with recommendations? Just real quick.
Yeah, real quick, I think they should avoid the post form. The most important thing they can have is a durable power of attorney for health care that's appointing someone to speak in their name, to represent them and make decisions at the time, at the place, and, of course, tell that person, you know, how much extraordinary treatment they want.
Right.
But there, nothing can substitute for making a decision at the time,
right.
you know, when the condition is known and the options are known.
Great. Thanks again, John, for coming on the Catholic Doctor Show. It's always a pleasure to have you. I would recommend that you go to the National Catholic Bioethics Center for more information on this topic of POLST and also to the Catholic Medical Association website at www.cathmed.org, and you can read the white paper. You've been listening to the Catholic Doctor Show on St. Gabriel Catholic Radio. Until next week, we hope your week is happy, healthy, and holy.
God bless.
The Catholic Doctors is a production of listener-supported St. Gabriel Catholic Radio, AM 820. Archives of The Catholic Doctors with Dr. Michael Parker and Dr. Will Turek are available at stgabrielradio.com. Veni, Sancti, Spiritus,
Veni, Penaria. I didn't take my faith seriously, which probably means I never really got it. To begin with, no, I didn't want to give up sin. I mean, the reason we sin is because sin is fun, but it's self-love sin. But it's amazing with God's grace how easy trying to not sin it really is.
If you've been away from the Catholic Church for whatever reason, we invite you to take another look. Visit CatholicsComeHome.org today.
Many support a woman's right to choose, but sadly, few know the consequences of those choices. The Catholic Medical Association supports your right to know. Women who have had an abortion are at higher risk for complications in future pregnancies, especially premature birth and low birth weight of their children. This puts their babies at risk for breathing problems, feeding problems, infections, heart problems, anemia, and eye problems. To find out more, visit cathmed.org.